Welcome once again to our program, which is the beginning of a new program. We're talking about the intelligent design, ID, some people call it, the intelligent design and biological evolution debate that goes on throughout our country today, particularly concerning public schools and our Catholic response to this intelligent design and biological evolution debate. I'm Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick Parish in Terre Haute. Our guest, as usual today, is whom I call our resident scholar, Ron Eldred, who teaches religion and history at John Paul II Catholic High in Terre Haute. A few months ago, we delivered a series of reasons to believe. Not just what does the Bible say, but what does logic and what does thinking without revelation enable us to conclude, and it's called Catholic apologetics. And we discussed, among other things, numerous proofs of God's existence just from reason. One of the main arguments that makes it reasonable, logical, to believe in God's existence is the intelligent design argument, which has become so forefront today. Today we are beginning a short series on intelligent design and the debate that has been going on in the country for the past several years, and particularly about whether it can or should be taught in public schools as an alternative to the theory of evolution. I'd like to begin the discussion today by asking Ron, our resident scholar. Ron, what is the argument of intelligent design? A lot of people have heard the word, but I think, like myself, don't really know a whole lot about it.
Intelligent design can be considered on at least two levels. One level is at the philosophical level, such as we discussed in our series on Reasons to Believe. The other is at the level of science, involved with the debate that has been going on in this country regarding the teaching of intelligent design in the public schools.
Okay, what is the philosophical level or the reasoning level regarding intelligent design that we discussed on our radio series, Reasons to Believe, Catholic Apologetics, a few months ago?
Well, for those listeners who missed our discussion, during this series, St. Thomas, you know, had what was called his five ways for proving God's existence from an observation of nature, or at least to make it possible to believe that he does exist. And the Macmillan Encyclopedia of Philosophy, this is from the 1967 edition, states in an article on the teleological argument for the existence of God, that's the name of the article that's in this encyclopedia, quote, "The world exhibits teleological order, design, adaptation." That's what is meant by
so
that.
So teleological means design.
Yes.
Okay.
"Therefore, it was produced by an intelligent designer." End of quote. As this definition states, intelligent design is also called the teleological arguments for God's existence. And telos is the Greek word for design or plan or purpose. Now, St. Thomas, we talked about St. Thomas Aquinas quite a bit in our series on Reasons to Believe. He was a Dominican priest, theologian, and philosopher who lived in the 13th century. One historian has called it the greatest of centuries. He's called the Doctor Angelicus, which means, in English, that's Latin, the angelic doctor. He's considered one of the greatest theologians and philosophers ever to have lived. And two of his most famous works, the Summa Contra Gentiles and the Summa Theologica, I've seen that pronounced two different ways or spelled two different ways. I've seen it Theologica and I've seen it Theologia. I've seen it both ways. And in fact, I'm reading two books on St. Thomas right now. And in one book, they use it one way, and the other book, they use it the other way. So, quite frankly, I'm not sure, you know, which one is most acceptable.
Now, is it correct to say Contra Gentiles, or however we're going to pronounce it, in Summa Theologica, One is more approached from reason, and the other is from revelation.
Well, the assuming the contra gentilis is more from reason.
Okay.
While the Summa Theologica is actually a summary. Basically, it was a summary of the whole Catholic faith at that time.
Okay.
There have been other summaries. Those kind of summaries were pretty common back in the 12th and 13th centuries. But St. Thomas, he was able to take every doctrine that the Catholic Church has and able to look at all the objections that had been given to these doctrines and then provide answers.
And see how all the pieces fit together in the big overview puzzle.
Yes, that was his main accomplishment, actually, was not only compiling all of them, but showing how they all fit together so nicely. But those are two of the finest examples, of course, of his work. He had a lot of other work. He did a lot of biblical commentaries and things of that sort as well. But nonetheless, he believed that human beings could reason from the observation of God's creation or nature to the proof of his existence. And to do this, he developed five ways for proving God's existence. Essentially, his five arguments can be broken down into two. The first one is the argument of intelligent design, and what are we going to be focusing on during this whole, but from a scientific point of view, during this whole series. And this is also called the teleological argument. And then the second approach, or the second argument, is from what's called causation, also known as the cosmological argument, which we went through a little bit in our series on apologetics. And this is from the Greek word cosmos, meaning the cause of the world or universe as a system and everything that's in it. St. Thomas says that common sense tells us that the universe works in such a way that one can conclude that an intelligent designer, that is God, designed it. In other words, all physical laws and the order of nature and life were designed and ordered by God, the intelligent designer. Peter Kreeft, a professor of philosophy at Boston College, we quoted him quite frequently in our series on apologetics. He uses a syllogism to prove that there must be a universal designer. And a syllogism is a form of logic with which we strive to ascertain the truth of something. It starts out with a statement called a major premise that is proven to be universally true. It is followed by another statement called a minor premise that is a particular application of that universal truth. And this then is followed with a conclusion logically based on these two premises, premises.
So it's a way of reasoning.
It's a way of reasoning,
to,
yes.
Another truth that may not be so clear.
It's a little more systematic than, you know, just common sense.
Okay.
It's almost a kind of a mathematical kind of thing to some extent.
And used in philosophy all the time.
If the major and minor premises are proven true, then the conclusion that follows is also true. And so in syllogistic form, the intelligent design argument goes like this. There's the major premise. Where there is evidence design, there must be a designer. That's a statement that's taken as universally true. Now, to be able to prove that would take a lot of time. That has to be proven. How do we know that that statement's true? And as I said, there's a rather sophisticated argument that proves that.
And that's what Catholic apologetics gets involved in.
That's what, yes.
From reason.
And then you have the minor premise. Evidence of design exists throughout the universe. That's a particular application of that universal principle. Again, that would have to be proven to be true.
Okay.
And St. Thomas does those kind of things, of course, in his Summa. And then finally, from those two premises, the major premise and the minor premise, both of which have been proven to be true, then there is a conclusion that's drawn from that. And the way that goes is, according to Peter Kreeft, is, therefore, there must be a universal designer. We call this designer God.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the development of these arguments philosophically. Philosophy means philia, love, Sophia, the love of wisdom. And there's been a love of wisdom way back through history, and that's why philosophy, trying to use our reason and our mind without revelation to come to important conclusions about reality. So say a little bit about how far this history goes back in philosophy.
Well, these arguments are ancient. For philosophers had long debated whether the complexity of nature indicates the existence of a purposeful, natural, or supernatural designer or creator. I think we find the first recorded arguments for a natural designer in Greek philosophy beginning with Plato in the 4th century BC, followed by his student Aristotle, who developed the idea of a natural creator of the cosmos, often referred to as, at least he referred to, as the prime mover, the first mover of all things. We briefly looked at those kind of things in our series.
And mover could be called the beginner.
Yes.
Okay.
This was in his book, The Metaphysics. Also, the Roman orator and philosopher of the natural law, Cicero, in his On the Nature of the Gods, said that, quote, "The divine power to be found in a principle of reason which pervades the whole of nature," end of quote. As we said earlier, this line of reasoning has come to be known as the teleological argument for the existence of God. St. Thomas's teleological argument is the most famous form of the argument, although a man by the name of William Paley, an Englishman in the early 19th century, wrote a book called Natural Theology, and he used another analogy, and it was called the watchmaker analogy.
Okay.
And so God would be, you know, sort of like the watchmaker who designed it and created it and what have you, which I understand is still widely used in some intelligent design arguments. I came across it a few times myself. The watchmaker analogy and other such arguments led to the development of what was called natural theology in the 19th century.
Okay, let me just break in there one moment just to help people about that watchmaker analogy, because I always was appealing to me. It's the idea, if a person was walking along a desert sand and found a watch and had never seen a watch before, a primitive native and the like, after looking at the watch and seeing the parts all moving inside, and seeing how the hands moved around, and they would go trace it with the sun and the like, that a person would naturally conclude the wind didn't blow this thing together, that there had to be some intelligent, very gifted designer who put this little design watch together. And, of course, that's what they're saying about the universe.
Yes.
Okay. Well, can we go on with that natural theology?
Natural theology was the study of biological phenomena as a search to understand what they call the mind of God back in the 19th century. Well, this natural theology movement stimulated scientists to collect fossils and other biological specimens that would ultimately lead to Darwin's theory of the origin of the species. In fact, Darwin was one of these collectors himself. He went on a famous voyage that we won't get into, the voyage of the Beagle, and several years when he was quite a young man, and he visited the Galapagos Islands and other places where he began to look at nature and then making inference from some of that, and where he developed his theories.
Now, fossils are the centuries-old remains in stone.
Yes.
Of footprints or bone prints.
Of any kind of living forms that lived at that time.
Okay.
Yes.
But they were ossified.
Yes.
Okay.
Many of today's advocates of theistic evolution postulate a divine designer, much as did the 19th century theistic scientists. So in a sense, you could say that those who are involved with creationism, which we'll look at later on, or with intelligent design, or, you know, basically sort of following in the footsteps of these people who were involved with this natural theology back in the 19th century.
And again, the natural theology is what is based on reason and observation and conclusion from it.
Yeah, theistic evolution.
Revelation, not the Bible.
Yeah, it's the idea that the theory of evolution is completely compatible with the concept of an intelligent, supernatural designer. In other words, it's just simply the way God did it.
Okay.
I mean, you know, that's the easiest way I could put it.
Well, that's a nice, popular way to put it. Is there any connection, Ron, between this 19th century natural or reasoning theology and natural evolution or intelligent design theory that's so talked about today?
Yes, there is. late 20th century intelligent design theory can be considered a modern development of this natural theology, which attempts to change the basis of science and, I guess, also undermine evolution theory. As evolutionary theory has become more complex, though, the examples that are held up as evidence of intelligent design have changed. But the essential argument has remained the same, that complex biological systems imply an intelligent designer. This goes back to your little story about the native, you know, finding the watch, you know, and goodness, that something, you know, very intelligent had to design this and to build this and what have you. But we're talking, of course, about the whole universe. And obviously for the universe, which is everything, then obviously this takes the greatest of all intelligence, the prime mover, the great intellect, or the great architect, or whatever, you know, you want to call God. But modern intelligent design scientists have offered examples that include the eye, the feathered wing.
Human eye.
Yes.
Okay.
These are very complex things, you see. Biochemical protein functions such as blood clotting and bacteria flagella, all of these, they claim, require an intelligent designer and simply could not be the result of blind chance.
Okay. And you said, and I know by purpose, intelligent design scientists. In other words, these are people who study the complexity in the scientific world and then conclude it's too complex without some kind of intelligent designer behind it.
And we'll get into the scientific aspect and get out of this philosophical part. We'll actually look at some of the specific arguments that they put forth.
All right, good. Now, do the modern advocates of intelligent design equate an intelligent designer with God?
Well, some of them try deliberately not to. Perhaps so as not to alert to or to alarm the opponents of the theory.
Okay.
They usually simply state that one or more intelligent designers must exist. While they might not name the designer, many intelligent designers believe the designer is the Christian God, though. And opponents, they claim that their refusal to openly identify God as the designer is nothing but a position taken to avoid alienating those who would separate religion from science courses taught in the public schools. We'll get into that subject in some detail later on.
Okay, so this is really ending out in a great debate about whether intelligent design can and should be taught in public schools. It has a very practical resonance in state legislatures and governments today, even gone up to the Supreme Court.
Before we go on to intelligent design as the scientific aspects of it, basically this is pretty well completes our discussion involved with the philosophical or logical aspect of intelligent design.
Okay. Now, let's talk about evolution for a moment. It's intelligent design is contrasted with the theory of evolution. And I stress the theory because there's argument about, is it a hypothesis? Is it a theory? How sound is it? How acceptable is it? Let's examine the meaning of evolution before we talk about more about intelligent design.
From a scientific point.
From a scientific
yes.
point.
Well, I think it's important that we discuss this topic. In other words, what is evolution? Because intelligent design arguments were formulated, in part at least, to counteract the teaching of evolution or the theory of evolution or the hypothesis of evolution in the public schools.
So it had a very practical ramification.
Yes.
To do something to change education in United States public schools.
The term evolution has been applied to gradual changes. So now we're going to actually see what it is. It's been applied to gradual changes of physical, biological, and social phenomena. Now, we are here interested only in the biological evolution. There's also a cosmological evolution that deals, you know, with the whole universe and physical evolution. And there have been a number of philosophers and social scientists who developed theories dealing with social evolution and societies evolving. People like Herbert Spencer, for example, back in the 19th century.
What is the difference between physical evolution and biological evolution?
Well, the physical would have to do with the Earth and the
and
the evolving of the Earth. It'd be sort
material.
Of like, yeah, it could be associated with the Big Bang theory, you know, and that kind of thing.
Okay. So when we're talking about biological evolution, we're talking about the evolution of living things.
Living things. And, okay. And that's what we're going to focus on exclusively.
Okay.
And biological evolution is defined as change in populations of organisms over generations. And essentially, this is based on the fact that offspring differ from their parents in various ways. And by parents and offspring, of course, I mean of living things. In this case, as you stated a while ago. And when these differences are helpful to survival, the offspring have a greater chance to survive and reproduce, making the differences more common in the next generation. And by this process, differences can accumulate over time, leading to major changes in a population. This process is called natural selection, which means that nature does the selecting. Natural selection is one of the cornerstones of modern biology, and the term was introduced by Charles Darwin in his book, The Origin of the Species, which he published in 1859 in England. And he arrived at the term by analogy with artificial selection, by which farmers select their breeding stock. In other words, he had gone out and studied this whole phenomenon and saw how farmers would select certain animals with different traits and then breed these animals, and then of course there would be a gradual micro kind of evolutionary change taking place. But that's a difference than what's called the macro evolution. Macro evolution means new species come into existence. And of course, obviously those who advocate the theory of evolution would argue, and beginning with Darwin, that that's how new species did come into existence, was through this whole process of gradual change. Today we would call it genetic mutation, and then natural selection, nature actually selecting the more fit to survive.
Okay. Well, what did Darwin see, and then we'll talk about Catholic position a little bit later on some of these things. What did Charles Darwin see as the mechanism that evolutionary change, how did it come, what was happening inside?
Yeah, what caused it, yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, he didn't know. They didn't really know the mechanisms of change back then. And okay. But when Darwin, he formulated his theory of natural selection.
This was in 18...
This would have been in the 1860s, or 1840s and 50s at most of this. He was living at Downhouse at the time and almost in kind of semi-retirement. He had a lot of money. He inherited quite a bit of money from his father, who had been a very successful medical doctor. Plus, he married Joshua Wedgwood's daughter, who was the big pottery maker, one of the world's most prominent pottery makers.
Wedgwood,
yeah. They make fine china, fine furniture. I mean, fine china, fine dishes, things of that sort.
That was his mother's family?
Yes, his mother. His wife's family.
Oh, wife family.
And she brought a big dowry.
Okay.
You know, a lot of money. And so he never really had to work.
Okay.
He
spent all his time in scientific...
Yeah, he bought a rather large estate. They call it Down House on the Down Estate. He was sort of like the country gentleman there. In fact, I think he only left, if I recall right, this estate once. And during his whole life, when he finally went there, when he was probably in his middle to late 30s or early 40s.
Okay.
But today we know that the evolutionary process is called by changes in genes, the blueprint or recipe for constructing the organism. When an organism reproduces, small random changes in the gene make the offspring somewhat different from the parent. Sometimes these changes give an organism the ability to survive and reproduce. And when this occurs, the gene for the beneficial traits are passed on to the organism's own offspring, making these genes more common in the next generation. And genes that don't help organisms to reproduce possibly become more rare or might even be completely eliminated from the population. And as I said, in evolutionary theory, this process is called natural selection. That is, nature itself does the selecting. Through the process of natural selection, populations of organisms slowly change over a period of time as they adapt to changes in their environment. The scientific theory of evolution is that all living things are descended from a single common ancestor. This is called common descent, and it holds that since life begins on Earth, evolution has transformed the first species into more and more different species as life has found a variety of ways to survive and flourish. And this has resulted in many types of life that exist today, including human life. In other words, all life initially came from one form of life.
Perhaps even a microscopic form of life?
It would have had to have been, initially.
Okay. So at least that's the theory,
yes,
of Darwin. All right. What does the concept of survival of the fittest mean?
Well, many believe that Darwin coined this concept, but actually it was coined by Herbert Spencer in his Principles of Biology. He was a philosopher, an English philosopher in the 19th century. He applied the idea of natural selection to social and economic evolution. And so survival of the fittest is a phrase associated with competition for survival or predominance, usually, amongst human beings more than anything. But it's a metaphor, not a scientific concept. And biologists usually don't use the term or the phrase. They prefer to use the term natural selection instead.
Okay, we're getting towards the close. So who supports Darwin's theory of evolution?
Well, it's supported in particular by a great majority of the biologists and in general by the scientific community at large. I've read that over 70 scientific societies, institutions and other professional groups who represent tens of thousands of scientists have issued policy statements that endorse the teaching of evolution into public schools and oppose the teaching of intelligent design. And many of these say that what controversy exists is not over the validity of the theory itself, but over the details of the mechanisms of evolution. In other words, there are several different varieties of evolutionary theory. And this runs contrary to the claim of intelligent design proponents that the theory of evolution is a theory in crisis. We're going to look at that later on. Critics of intelligent design say that there's no fundamental controversy, there's no crisis among scientists over the validity of the theory of evolution. They claim that the intelligent design movement, quote, is a veneer over a certain theological message. Every one of these groups, they're talking about intelligent design groups, they say, is now actively engaged in trying to undercut sound science education by criticizing evolution, end of quote. And we're going to look at the validity of some of these claims in a later session.
So, Ron, as we come to our conclusion of the wonderful presentation, I think you've given us about intelligent design and evolution. It really boils down to that there are scientists, competent scientists on both sides, although many more favoring evolution, but scientists saying intelligent design needs to be taught in the public schools, and evolutionist scientists say, no, it should not, because it's really a theology, it's a explanation, and it would violate the First Amendment of the Constitution about religion. So we're going to talk about both of those ideas, but it has practical ramifications in this whole debate about states voting to teach intelligent design or to teach both, or to teach the controversy. So we hope you can stay with us in our programs as we continue. May God bless you always and in always.